This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Angolans have elected their first new president in nearly four decades, and they say he must address the glaring gap between rich and poor. Despite being Africa's second largest oil producer, most of Angola's citizens live in poverty amid runaway inflation and high unemployment.
That's VOA's Anita Power reporting from Luanda. Details next.
Also, official hearings open today after Kenya's Supreme Court granted the opposition to challenge the presidential poll results, and rescue workers are struggling to reach thousands of people stranded by raging floodwaters in the fourth biggest American city, Houston, Texas.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Angolans have elected their first new president in nearly four decades, and they say he must address the glaring gap between rich and poor, despite being Africa's second largest oil producer. Most of Angolan's citizens live in poverty amid runaway inflation and high unemployment. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Luanda.
On a good day, Kialopa Feliciana brings in about $18 selling food at this market in an impoverished Luanda neighborhood. The business is very expensive, she told VOA one recent morning, as she churned a large pot of maize porridge, stopping to wipe sweat off her brow. That is why I've got little money for home expenses. Angola's economy is so crippled by inflation that her daily take-home is worth about $9. Her entire family depends on that, she says, because although her adult son has a certificate, he cannot find a job in a nation where unemployment hovers around 26%. But across town, mansions, million-dollar condominiums, and upscale stores line a few city blocks. At a high-end gelato shop, patrons can spend Feliciana's entire daily income in one outing. Retiring President José Eduardo dos Santos lives here, in a yellow mansion that overlooks the busy port and a maze of slums on the hill below. During his 38-year rule, he has been consistently accused of spending the government's oil income on himself and his inner circle. Here, the wide roads are paved and lined with old-growth trees and pretty tiled signs, a holdover from Portuguese rule that ended in 1975. In Feliciana's treeless neighborhood just a few kilometers away, the roads are unpaved, and mounds of stinking waste sit just meters from homes where toddlers play in the dirt. Angola is Africa's second largest oil producer, yet that wealth has clearly not trickled down. President-elect João Lourenço, who is Dos Santos' chosen heir, says he wants to lessen dependence on oil. He wants to develop agriculture, industry, tourism, fisheries, and other branches of the economy, he told a crowd at his final pre-election rally. But his political opponents say the problem is far simpler. Opposition lawmaker Manuel Fernandes. The poverty is not because of a drop in prices, he told VOA. It is because of bad governance. But longtime government critic and journalist Rafael Marques says Lourenço is in a difficult situation because Dos Santos still controls much of the nation's wealth.
The question is, how is he going to run the country without money? Because these individuals who were members of the government and some are living like President Dos Santos, they're living with a tight control over the economic assets of the country, which they will not pass on to the new president.
It is a tough situation for Lourenço as he prepares to take the reins once the official count is settled. But for Angola's millions of poor, change cannot come soon enough. Anita Powell, VOA News, Luanda, Angola.
Kenya's Supreme Court granted the opposition access to all official tally forms and the Electoral Commission's computer servers as official hearings open today on the opposition's challenge to presidential poll results. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Following pretrial discussions over the weekend, the Supreme Court has begun hearing arguments on the opposition party's petition contesting results of the August 8th presidential election. The official results showed President Uhuru Kenyatta defeating Raila Odinga by about 1.4 million votes. Since Election Day, the National Super Alliance, or NASA, opposition coalition has argued that the voting system was hacked, leading to what they call a stolen election. The Supreme Court's first order of business Monday was the opposition's request for access to the Electoral Commission's servers, which NASA says will provide the necessary evidence to support their argument.
It is our order that the petitioners, as well as the third respondents, shall be granted a read-only access, which includes copying, if necessary, of the following information.
Some of the information that Justice Isaac Lena Olah listed included firewalls, password policy, system user types and levels of access, and GPS locations from each electoral kit. Lena Olah also said the parties would be given access to the official tally forms from the polling stations and constituencies. The court registrar will supervise these exercises, in which each party is permitted two agents to observe. Three court-appointed information and communication technology, or ICT, experts will also be present. A report about these exercises is due by 5 p.m. local time on Tuesday. The rest of Monday's hearing was scheduled for Odinga and Kenyatta's lawyers to argue their sides of the case, as well as the Electoral Commission to defend the integrity of its voting systems. The Supreme Court has until Friday to give its final ruling. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
At least 200 million girls and women have undergone female genital mutilation in 30 countries, and according to UNICEF, 44 million are girls 14 years old and younger. One group of Kenyan teens is standing up to this ancient so-called rite of passage and offering would-be victims a possible life-saving alternative, an app. Dina Mitchell reports from Silicon Valley, California.
It's still fresh in my mind. The scene of female genital mutilation. The pain of having your clitoris cut simply because someone wants to have you go through a rite of passage. It's painful and no one wants to listen to you. You cry and there you are, almost dying, but nobody is caring about that.
These teenage girls from Kenya call themselves the Restorers. Although their tribe does not practice female genital mutilation, or FGM, they are pitching a technology they developed to help other girls fight back against the archaic custom where all a part of a woman's clitoris is cut out.
I think for teenagers to be able to identify problems around them and provide a solution, that is really, really inspiring.
The Kenyan teens participated in the Technovation Challenge, which invites girls from around the world to compete using technology to solve problems in their communities. They created an app called iCut, allowing victims to send for help if they suspect they might be the target of FGM.
Around the place you are.
200 million girls in 30 countries have been cut. Africa, the Middle East, and Asia, where FGM is concentrated. Therefore, FGM is a global concern.
I had a friend who had to drop out of school because of female genital mutilation. And when I got the chance to work on this application, I had to do it because of what happened to my friend.
Though their app has the potential to save lives, it has not been embraced by all Kenyans.
One village elder drove 6 hours to their school to protest the app because, according to him, that's an African culture and the girls are being, according to him, westernized.
The new app comes at a time when some are protesting women and technology, and not just in Kenya, but even at the Google headquarters where the competition is being held. Google CEO Sundar Pichai made an unplanned appearance at the event.
I know the journey won't always be easy, but to the girls who dream of being an engineer or an entrepreneur and who dream of creating amazing things, I want you to know that there's a place for you in this industry. There's a place for you at Google. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
The Restorers did not win Technovation Challenge, but they will continue their fight against FGM and hope to get their app into the Google Play Store soon. Dina Mitchell for VOA News, Mountain View, California.
Fifteen past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Houston, Texas, the fourth biggest American city, braced for more tropical storm rains today, with rescue workers struggling to reach thousands of people already stranded by raging floodwaters. Forecasters expected the storm that came ashore as Hurricane Harvey on Friday night to drop as much as 25 centimeters of new rainfall around Houston, and that another 40 to 60 centimeters could fall through Wednesday. The region has already seen more than 60 centimeters of rain in some places. While the hurricane force winds have diminished, I want to stress that we are not out of the woods yet, said acting U.S. Homeland Security Chief Ellen Duke. She said rivers in South Texas won't crest until later this week. Duke added, right now we are focused on rescue operations and will move into recovery operations later in the week. But today we are deeply concerned with those in Houston and surrounding areas who are stranded and in need of immediate assistance. People need help and we are working to provide it, he said. Federal Emergency Management Administrator Brock Long said, we are anticipating over 30,000 people being placed in shelters temporarily to basically stabilize the situation and provide for their care. Next, we are ready and already deploying life essential commodities. I'm asking all citizens to get involved, Long said. President Donald Trump, set to visit Texas on Tuesday, already has declared the state a disaster area, making it eligible for assistance from the national government, and on today designated parts of the neighboring state of Louisiana as well.
In Uganda, the fall army worm caterpillars that ravage crops in some African countries are back. In March, Uganda confirmed the outbreak of the devastating caterpillars known for ravaging crops. According to government statistics, Uganda produces 4 million metric tons of maize annually. Maize, which is the most affected crop, contributes to the livelihoods of more than 3.6 million households. The second outbreak comes on the heels of a drought and low rainfall. Christopher Kibazanga is the state minister for agriculture. Reporter Halima Atumanyi asked him whether adequate control measures were in place to stop the spread and now second outbreak of the devastating fall army worm.
We are facing another outbreak of fall armyworm. A fall armyworm which is a bit resistant to the current chemicals on the market. And of course, after harvesting, it seems to have been defeated. And also when it rains, it appears as if it has been defeated. But as you know, it's a life cycle. It can hibernate somewhere. And when you start planting, it comes out. But this time we were more than prepared because of the previous experience. Our people are there, first of all, to demonstrate to the farmers on how to fight the fall armyworm. Two, to deliver some demonstration chemicals and guide our farmers where to get the effective chemicals and the prescription on how to use them.
But Honorable, the last time you also went out and you demonstrated, as you have said, how are we going to ensure that these chemicals are the right chemicals for these farmers to
use? Yes, I must admit that yes, the other time we declared Rocket and Striker as the effective chemical to fight the armyworm. But as you know, and I really regret this, somehow we had liberalized agrochemicals to the open market. But we are finding it very difficult because immediately we declared these two chemicals, counterfeit chemical, and they started faking farmers. And we are very angry about it. By this time around, we have identified a farm in France which is going to supply chemicals directly to the Ministry of Agriculture. And we store them in our store in one day here, and then distribute them ourselves through operation multiplication and the NADS and the officials of the ministry have told you in the field. And we're also planning to open up regional centers so that we direct all our farmers to to go and buy from those certified centers.
Now that you're mentioning about buying from certified centers, the other thing was that most of our farmers are not really well off. Some of them are complaining the chemicals when they're on the market, they're quite expensive. Are you going to give it to them at subsidized prices?
For instance, the ones that our teams took, they are free to the farmers. But also, district production officers, we have instructed them to come and pick and go and distribute to the farmers, especially in the areas where we grow maize and areas which are most affected. And of course, we have been emphasizing that agriculture is a business, and they are business people in the field of agriculture who have got the capacity to purchase their own agrochemicals. But also, we are recommending that they buy from the controlled, the certified distributors.
Your preparedness. I know you have talked about all these contingency plans you have in place. But then the last time, I think you got little money to fight the fall armyworm, and that's why there was a spread to almost 100 districts. Are we sure that the government this time around is going to give you enough funds to contain this new outbreak so that it doesn't spread?
It is true, we did not get all the money we had wanted. But the good news is that they released 2.4 billion at that time. And of course, the pesticides we had purchased, some of them, we still had them in the stores because we did not use all of them. And of course, another good news is the outbreak. It's the first quarter of a financial year. And therefore, we have some resources, and we have used these resources to purchase more chemicals.
That was Christopher Kibazanga, Uganda's State Minister for Agriculture. He spoke with reporter Halima Atumani from Kampala, Uganda.
Economic analysts say the number of black South Africans entering the country's middle class has swelled to about 6 million. The government's affirmative action policies have resulted in black people being employed in posts such as teaching and the civil service. Under apartheid, jobs like this were largely reserved for whites. Being more financially rewarded means many salaried black individuals have left the poor urban townships where they grew up for more affluent suburbs, where only white people lived during racial segregation. However, many have also left their traditional food and recipes behind in the townships. But as Darren Taylor reports, that is changing.
Ponso Pilane tucks into a coil of vors, beef and pork sausage flavored with spices, in a restaurant in Johannesburg. She writes about culture for South Africa's Mail and Guardian newspaper. Pilane was raised in a rural village where eating traditional food was the norm.
It was something that we had every single day. Things like McDonald's or KFC was the luxury that we'd have on a Friday night or Saturday evening for supper.
Her ethnicity is Botswana. Their staple food is a heavy brown sorghum porridge.
Usually before we cook the mabele pap, we let it ferment for about 1 or 2 days. So it has a bit of a sour aftertaste. And that we usually would have with boiled chicken.
Pilana and her family would also eat morocho, or wild spinach, and meat smothered in chakalaka.
Chakalaka is baked beans mixed with fried carrots and chilies.
Pilane watched with sadness in recent years as black South Africans' entry into the middle class sparked their mass consumption of fast food. And as they moved into better neighborhoods, so they began eating at expensive restaurants offering European-style cuisine. But now Pilane says she's noticing a desire among more of her middle-class compatriots to rediscover their culinary roots. And eateries once confined to the townships are moving into suburbs like Melville. Observing the trend, chefs recently opened the Grill Lounge here a few months ago. It serves only South African recipes, with not a burger or baguette in sight. Waitress Stephanie Buys delivers customers dishes like mohodu.
Mukhodu is tripe, basically.
And that is the sheep's stomach?
Yes, either sheep or cow. We don't usually use a lot of spice in our traditional foods because it kills the flavor. So we just use water, salt, potatoes.
Another Xhosa delicacy she presents is manqina, or pig feet. Like the mokhodu, manqina is braised for hours until tender and enjoyed by local school teacher Sarah Tabane. She says she's happy she no longer has to drive to faraway townships to buy traditional food. Pilane says places like the Grill Lounge are evidence of South Africa's strengthening black economy and also of cultural development.
And it shows that's how culture becomes mainstream, when the people that belong to that culture are included in the mainstream economy, in the formal living arrangements, and in the bigger picture of society.
Yoda, can I have a sirloin, living salad, mushroom sauce, and mustard salad, please?
Steve Maresh calls an order in the kitchen of his steakhouse. Even restaurants like his, where millionaires dine, are now serving indigenous food. Maresh serves his expensive meat with pap, a stiff snow white maize porridge.
When we're doing something unusual, we'd add some creamed sweet corn to it and a herb and spice mix. But generally it's kept traditional but served with a very hearty, delicious tomato pepper relish.
But Pelane warns that some opportunists are gentrifying traditional recipes. She cites the township kota. That's a quarter loaf of bread filled with wors, drowned in a spicy tomato and onion sauce called achar.
I was shocked when I found out that there's a restaurant that opened, owned by white people, that sell kotas. But they don't sell it using the loaf of bread. They use fancy, really almost absurd stuff like ciabatta bread and all these.
But Pilane's enjoying the irony, as she puts it, of Western-style food being increasingly replaced by traditional recipes in South African diets. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Dan Crafton, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello Africa, this is James Brotte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5 and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.